Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
And so it has come to this. Not Greece, not Italy, not Portugal, Spain, or Ireland, but Germany at the mercy of the bond market. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 23rd of November. Good to have you with us. And let's try an experiment in participatory podcasting, shall we? We've been covering the European debt crisis for so long now. You surely know the basic plot outlines as well as I do. Here you go. Germany is, come on, say it with me, the strongest economy in Europe, the very heart of the Eurozone. So when the German government went to the bond markets this morning and couldn't sell all the debt it had on offer, why, that, my friends, was a nixed good thing. Wasn't so much the amount in question. It was the idea that investors are now gun-shy about debt that just a couple of days ago was the best Europe had to offer. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has the latest on the ever-widening continental debt crisis.
The German government was left holding more than $3 billion worth of bonds, or buns, as they call them. Julian Pendock of Sennhaus Capital says this is a bad sign.
German bonds no longer look like the fail-safe safe haven that they have been seen as to date.
He says Germany's creditworthiness has been damaged by its Eurozone partners. Italy and Spain are in deep trouble. Even France could lose its AAA rating. Germany may have to carry alone the weight of bailing out its neighbours. Albrecht Ritschl is with the London School of Economics.
Now it turns out that the whole debt burden of Southern Europe combined is quite a bit too big to be shouldered even by the Germans.
It's argued there's one way to solve the debt crisis at a stroke, for the European Central Bank to print money and buy vast quantities of government bonds. The Germans have vehemently rejected that move as inflationary. Julian Pendock believes Berlin might now soften its stance.
If their own bonds are starting to need support, then the German government might change their mind to say, well, actually, we would now support the ECB starting to print money.
But Ansgar Belker of the DIW think tank in Berlin believes the German government is now, very privately, mulling a radically different approach to the debt crisis.
It's time now to discuss Germany's exit from the euro area. This would not be done by Merkel, of course, in a public way, but of course they are working on a plan B.
And Albrecht Ritschl says the German public might not complain if the country did leave the eurozone.
That would be hugely popular in Germany, going it alone.
But the cost of the eurozone collapsing for Germany, for Europe and for the global economy would be huge. In spite of today's serious setback, the German government seems certain to soldier on, carrying the euro. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
One last word about German debt to put today's failed bond auction into a little bit of context. The yield on the notes offered today by the German central government? 2% plus or minus, well below, say, Italian or Spanish debt, right in line, though, with what the U.S. 10-year bond goes for. For those of you who have yet to hone your Black Friday retail combat skills, drop and give me 20. You got less than a day and a half before stores open, and it's going to be rough out there. The National Retail Federation expects 150 million shoppers to hit the stores over the weekend. That's up 10% from last year, but sales, on the other hand, are expected to rise only about 1.5%. But Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports Black Friday is also about what comes next.
Dina O'Leary has been braving Black Friday sales in the suburbs of Seattle for nearly a decade. The first store she always hits is regional chain Fred Meyer.
They have this huge sale on socks.
That's right. Not flat screen TVs, not toys, not cashmere sweaters. 50% off socks.
If it wasn't for the half-price socks, we probably wouldn't be hitting Fred Meyer as our first place.
But those socks give Fred Meyer a toehold on Dina O'Leary. Britt Beamer is with America's Research Group. He says a shopper who comes into a store on Black Friday is 60% more likely to come back during the holiday season.
If you win on Black Friday with shoppers, you've got a great chance of at least having a good Christmas season. If you don't win with shoppers on Black Friday, you're going to be a retail museum for the rest of Christmas season.
Beamer says shoppers who get a great deal may also spend more than expected.
Families will budget their entire Christmas season around what happens on Black Friday morning.
Retailers also use the sales as a guide to their future. Faith Hope Consolo is a retail analyst with Prudential Douglas Elliman.
It really is the barometer on what's going to sell, what's not going to sell.
And retail strategist Megan Donadio of Kurt Salmon says they're testing new deals all day long.
You're going to hear about certain retailers that have, you know, every hour they might have a special.
Because they don't just want to get you in the door early, they want you to stick around. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Anybody know how to say sad music in German? Because that'd be appropriate right about now. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. For those in the car or cab on the way to the airport, a word of advice, if I might. Grab something good to read for the inevitable wait. We've been hearing from writers on the show this week about the economy specifically and jobs and how they're thinking about what people are going through. Today, novelist Jess Walter.
I do think I write about work. It would be impossible to write about work right now and not note the fact that unemployment is at this high and that regular Americans are suffering in this way. I do think it's a really difficult and tragic time, and as a novelist, you know, you're drawn to those kinds of stories because of their inherent drama, but also their importance. In my neighborhood, I keep seeing what I think are yard sales until I get close and realize they're evictions. That's the sort of detail that sparks a novelist's mind and sends him back to the keyboard. You know, I just saw the economic numbers that came out recently, and it was so interesting because the economy had gone up 1.3%, but corporate profits were up 4%. And to me, therein lies the issue. You know, if corporations are making 4% more, why aren't there 4% higher employment numbers? We're stuck in a sort of swamp in which money's coming in, earnings are high. I've been calling this a jobless recovery, but it might just be a jobless economy we're talking about. After this jobless recovery or whatever it's called, I really think that there are people dealing with this at a level that I don't think we've seen in books or movies or television. I think the fine edge of poverty is a lot sharper than we're imagining right now.
Jess Walter is the author of The Financial Lives of Poets. Our series concludes tomorrow with Isabel Wilkerson. Take a second to write to us. Marketplace.org is the website. Click on that link that says contact. For all that's been written and said about the Occupy movement the past couple of months, there has been remarkably little coverage of how the thing actually started, beyond some vague mentions of a Canadian magazine called Adbusters. For this week's issue of The New Yorker, Mattathias Schwartz did the legwork digging into the origins of Occupy and talking to the guy who runs Adbusters, which is where we started when we spoke.
There's this older fellow, Culla Lawson, who publishes a magazine called Adbusters in Vancouver, Canada, and then he collaborates very closely with a much younger staff, one of whom is by the name of Micah White. He lives in Berkeley, California. And the origin of the Occupy Wall Street meme was exchanges by phone and by email in the daily brainstorms that Micah and Culla have.
So what was the original germ? What was the seed? Was there a precipitating moment that Culla Lawson said, all right, I got to do something?
In the beginning, there was not a whole lot to distinguish this Occupy Wall Street idea from the other ones that they bounced back and forth, like boycotts of Starbucks. So it just started off as another hashtag or another possible strategy that they were going to sort of toss out provisionally to their email list and see whether it took or not. And this one took. It took very quickly.
So that first day, though, the 17th of September, for all the Twitter and electronic revolution that we've seen in the Arab Spring and all that stuff, these guys were out there with paper maps, and it was decidedly and intentionally low tech.
That's right. They chose to keep it off of Twitter and off of email and to just select the location by number on paper maps, which they distributed immediately before everyone went up to location 5, which turned out to be Zuccotti Park.
And they sat down and started having, as you write, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for lunch.
It would have been a late lunch. It would have been the afternoon.
and
yeah, they'd been salting away food for at least a couple weeks, and they'd sort of thought through all these different contingencies. So you kind of had the idea guys in Vancouver and in Berkeley
right.
just sort of throwing this stuff out there and spitballing. And then you have these more hardcore organizers here in New York who take it up, who actually show up, and then who figure out ways to make it work on the ground.
One of the really interesting things, one of the other really interesting things, because there were a whole bunch of great tidbits in this piece, but one of them is that you quote either Kala Lawson or the guy from Berkeley, the younger guy, saying, we got to have a message. We really need a specific message. And yet that's sort of what Occupy became known for, at least in the early days, and even still, which is just the amorphousness of its message.
Yeah, that came from Micah White of Adbusters. At one point, he and Kala sat down and came up with a list of demands to give to President Obama, but the folks in New York did not want that. They did not want specific demands. And that, you know, that's part of the point, is being so disorganized as to be uncooptable. And how does that spread out further? That's the trickiest question right there.
Have you talked to any of these guys, to Kala Lawson or Micah White in Berkeley, or any of the folks you were on the ground with in Zuccotti Park, about how it's been cleared out now and they are no longer really occupying things and they're going to have to come up with another strategy?
A little bit. You know, I talked to Kala about that, and he was kind of cooking up possible ideas or memes for phase two, which would be, he said, like an escalation or more swarming disruptions against what he calls business as usual. I was at Zuccotti Park last night. There were only about 50 people there, and the occupation of Zuccotti Park, so far as I could see, for all intents and purposes, is over. So there are probably a great deal of people who are meeting and wondering and trying to figure out what to do next right now.
Yeah, as are we all, actually. Mattathias Schwartz wrote about the origins of Occupy Wall Street in this week's New Yorker magazine. It's a piece called Pre-Occupy. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up, all right, so here's the shopping list. Eggs, milk, cheese.
You're baking, you know, or fixing something, you know, and you need some. Well, you can't just run down the store and get it.
What happens when the only grocery store in town just shuts down? But first, let's do the numbers. Oh, yeah, Wall Street can be thankful tomorrow's a holiday. The Dow Industrials threw off 2% today, 236 points, closed at 11,257. The NASDAQ unloaded 2.4%, 61 points, 2460 at the bell. The S&P 500 took off 2.2%, 26 points, ended things at 1161. Usual suspects, in case, you know, I needed to tell you, European debt and tight consumer spending. Financial shares felt the heat. Bank of America let go more than 4%. JP Morgan Chase, Citigroup, and Morgan Stanley each forfeited more than 3.5%. With Black Friday just around the corner, how are retailers feeling? Yeah, not so good. Sears took off close to 5% today. Investors marked down Macy's shares 3%. JCPenney reversed 2.5%. Best Buy got worse by 1.75%. Some of the only good news came from Deere & Company, which picked up nearly 4% after strong sales and quarterly earnings. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note slipped to 1.89%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. Markets are closed. People cook and eat and watch football. People also watch the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. This year looks skyward for a new helium giant created by Tim Burton. B, a boy obsessed with flight, with the scars to prove it. And finally, in D.C., Season's Greetings opens. That's the holiday exhibit at the U.S. Botanic Garden. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Yeah, okay, so I know it's the day before Thanksgiving, but let's do a little time travel to the day after tomorrow, okay? The day of leftover turkey and cranberry sauce and stuffing. You add some bread and you got the fixins for a yummy sandwich. That, a good sandwich, is exactly the topic of John Chonko's new book, with a twist. The book is called Scanwiches. John, welcome to the program.
It's good to be here.
So let's explain what this is. You go out, you get sandwiches. Well, you tell people.
It's called Scanwiches, and it's basically what it sounds like. I go out and I get a sandwich, or I make a sandwich, and I put it on a flatbed scanner, just like a normal photo scanner, the kind most people have in their office or home,
mm-hmm.
and I scan it.
It's important to point out here, right? You cut it in half, and then you put the cut side down on the scanner.
Yeah, so I scan the sandwiches, and I let people know what's in the sandwich, and I let people know where I got it. Scanwich's official motto that started on the blog is for education and delight.
There you go.
And I just want to celebrate the sandwich mm-hmm. and make it look as best it can and get people excited about the way sandwiches are made and how cool sandwiches can actually be when you take them out of context.
Yeah, well, so explore that a little bit, because you do seem to be abnormally attached to sandwiches. What is it about them?
Oh, man. I think that, yeah.
And I say so that not pejoratively. It's just, you know, this is kind of unusual.
I'm kind of a history buff. And there's one way I like to think about sandwiches, which is as these, like, objects of history, these, like, pieces of culinary tradition that have sort of evolved and grown and actually, like, tell these really awesome stories about people and cultures and locations and cuisines. And the other thing I find really fascinating about sandwiches, you know, everybody sort of has an opinion on sandwiches. Mm-hmm. People know they don't want, you know, mustard on a sandwich, or they have, you know, a favorite sandwich. And that's not true of a lot of other types of food. I think sandwiches, more so than anything else, generate those kind of feelings.
Yeah, this is a little bit like asking somebody to pick their favorite kid, but do you have a favorite sandwich in this book?
Oh, man. The sandwich that was the most fun to make was the Dagwood.
Oh, yeah.
Because I don't think it was really ambitious of me. I don't think I would have attempted to make a sandwich like this.
And that is the classic, I mean, from the cartoon, right? It's the 19-layer, foot and a half high.
Yeah, Dagwood Bumstead, Blondie, you know, he goes to the fridge in the middle of the night and pulls out whatever's, you know, sitting inside the icebox and makes a sandwich out of it. It's kind of like the quintessential midnight snack, you know, piece of gluttony.
Oh, my God. I'm flipping through it as we talk, and you've got a Marmite sandwich in there.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
which
yeah.
is just not a delectable, tasty treat, I would say, but that's just me.
Well, I spent 6 months in London in 2005, and I tried Marmite for the first time. And was absolutely grossed out by it.
Let's tell people what it is and sort of what it tastes like, right? I mean, it's...
Oh, man. Okay, so for those who aren't aware, Marmite is the stuff that's left over from beer brewing. This is the stuff, like, most of the time they throw away.
Yeah, you know why they throw it away? They throw away because it's gross. But anyway, go ahead.
When I made the Marmite sandwich for the book, I tasted Marmite for the first time again in, you know, 5 years. And I was like, wow, I actually like this. I now eat Marmite fairly regularly.
And now that's actually on tape, and you know, it will live forever. I'm not seeing any, and this is just my own personal predilection at the moment. I'm really into open-faced sandwiches at the moment, and I'm not seeing any of those. Tough to scan, I imagine, right?
Tough to scan. Open-faced sandwiches are sort of, I consider them kind of a niche in the sandwich world. To me, a sandwich is ingredients held between bread. It has to be one of those things that, if you held it up to somebody and said, what is this? They would say, that's a sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
You just kind of know it, right? You know what a sandwich is. And if you have to debate it, then it's probably not a sandwich.
John Chonko's book is called Scanwiches. We've got some images from it. Scans, maybe? I don't know. On our website. It's marketplace.org/thebigbook. John, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Depending on where you live, it's probably still not too late to get a bird for the big meal tomorrow. But also, depending on where you live, getting a bird might be well nigh impossible. Rural America has been losing its grocery stores. Fewer people are living in the countryside, and mom-and-pop markets aren't always able to compete with the big chains. But Sylvia Maria Gross reports from KCUR in Kansas City. Some small towns are finding ways to buck the trend.
Last December, the only grocery store in Onega burned down. Onega is a town of about 700 in northeast Kansas, surrounded by cattle ranches, corn, and wheat farms. Suddenly, there was no place to buy groceries for 25 miles in any direction.
You're baking, you know, or fixing something, you know, and you need some. Well, you can't just run down the store and get it.
Althea Sender is 86 years old, lives alone, and doesn't drive long distances. Today she sits on a van sent by Pottawatomie County to take Onega's elderly and disabled a half hour away to the nearest grocery store. Sender and her fellow Onegan, 81-year-old Althea Fordham, yes, two Altheas, have been taking the van regularly since the local store closed. Fordham says she does most of her shopping in one monthly trip, but produce is tricky.
Oh, especially fresh fruits and vegetables. That's the hard thing to get a hold of.
Onega's become what's called a rural food desert, where residents live more than 10 miles away from anywhere that sells groceries. The USDA says at least 2 million other rural Americans are just like them. Those who can mostly drive the long distances to shop. But the impact goes beyond access to fresh food. Onega's grocery store was the anchor of the town's business district. Dan Peters runs the Onega branch of Morrill & Janes Bank. He says the local pharmacy and hardware store are among those struggling now that the grocery store is gone.
People now, I have to drive to get my groceries. You know, I need to pick up a screwdriver, a bag of nails, whatever it is. So instead of coming to the local hardware store, I'll just stop at Home Depot or some hardware store out of town while I'm there.
Town officials recognized the danger, and when the owners of the previous grocery store decided not to rebuild, they began aggressively courting other operators. There weren't any takers until Pam Budenbender came along.
I had always said it was my retirement plan. I was going to go into the grocery business.
Budenbender and her husband own businesses in Kansas City, but they spend their weekends on a farm outside of Onega. Budenbender hadn't planned on opening a store so soon.
It's very expensive to undertake, you know, from the ground up.
Banker Dan Peters and county officials helped Budenbender put together a package of low-interest rural development loans, but it wasn't enough to cover costs, so the Onega City Council decided to do something unusual. They kicked in $375,000 towards the new building. Mayor Gary Holthaus says it's an investment in the future.
I feel you need to do those things in rural communities if you want to survive.
That realization is coming to many towns in rural America. In the last 3 years, Kansas alone has lost nearly 90 small-town grocery stores. But like Onega, at least a dozen towns have come up with creative ways to finance replacements. Some have opened them as nonprofits. In others, residents buy shares in the stores. David Proctor runs the Rural Grocery Initiative at Kansas State University.
More and more in rural parts of the state and rural parts of the country, we will find a partnership between public and private dollars that go into establish and sustain these grocery stores.
The new grocery store in Onega is set to open December 1st. Owner Pam Budenbender watches as the first shipments arrive and the staff begins stocking the shelves.
Well, I think it really didn't become real to me until today when the food started going on the shelves. And it was like, oh my gosh, we have groceries.
To introduce the new store to the community, Budenbender plans to raffle off free hams and ice cream during the opening weekend. Businesses in town are counting on the grocery store to bring old customers back and maybe even draw in some new ones from the rest of the region. In Onega, Kansas, I'm Sylvia Maria Gross for Marketplace.
The obligatory turkey pardoning went down today at the White House. Liberty and Peace, each weighing in at 45 pounds, will live out their days at Mount Vernon. And there was also the obligatory presidential proclamation.
Tomorrow is one of the best days of the year to be an American. It's a day to count our blessings, spend time with the ones we love, and enjoy some good food and some great company.
2011 has been an economically trying year, more fits than start. So we wondered, as they carve their turkeys tomorrow, what Ben Bernanke and Tim Geithner might be thankful for. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith ventured a guess.
Unemployment? High. Housing market? A mess. Congress? Gridlocked on the deficit. Heartburn will probably be on the menu for Fed Chief Ben Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner this Thanksgiving. They're not talking, but Harvard economist Ken Rogoff says the two officials have plenty to be thankful for.
As miserable as things are and as high as unemployment is, it really could be a lot worse. And we're healing. And hopefully the coming year will bring more of that.
The economy is growing, albeit slowly. Bernanke's Federal Reserve has had a busy year buying U.S. Treasury bonds, pumping billions into the economy, and trying to encourage people to borrow money by keeping interest rates low.
I think Bernanke is most grateful for low inflation.
Jill Schlesinger is editor of CBS Money Watch and a former investment advisor. She says Bernanke couldn't do any of that if inflation started up. That's when the price of everything starts to climb uncontrollably, and that's a real risk when you add lots of money to the system. As far as Geithner's concerned, Schlesinger says he's probably thankful that the U.S. financial system is weathering the European storm.
For Geithner, it's all about, I just don't want the worst to happen again. And so far, it hasn't.
And that's what Georgetown finance professor Jim Angel imagines Bernanke is grateful for.
He's probably thinking, I'm glad we're not in the Eurozone.
And what about the Eurozone? What can it be grateful for this Thanksgiving?
Let me think about that one. At least we have good wine.
Great wine. And German banks. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which we learn once again that sometimes the news just falls right into your lap. Not only were two turkeys presidentially pardoned today, Turkey itself was spared by one of the ratings agencies. Fitch said it's bumping Turkey's outlook to positive from stable. The Turkish economy is supposed to grow 8% this year, which, given the German and European news of the day, is at least something to be thankful for. And that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media, on this Wednesday. Today, the Dow threw off 236 points, 2%. The NASDAQ unloaded 61 points, 2.4%. The S&P 500 took off 26 points, 2.2%. Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the program for us. Coming up next time, back here as the Thanksgiving meal looms, are you thinking maybe homemade is better than store-bought?
I would definitely make your pie crust. I would definitely make the pumpkin pie. But I did a test between pumpkin from a pumpkin and pumpkin from a can, and I'm all for the can.
You better hope the stores are still open. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.